and found himself staring into the big, meaty face of Goldberg, with its slits for eyes and its drooping black mustache. Then he looked at Martin again, and put on a brave and angry face.
"Just fixing a hubcap, champ. Got nothing to do with you."
Before he got to the word "you," he was already moving away from Martin with what was supposed to pass for a saunter. He opened the door of the Camaro and tossed the wrench in the back seat and sauntered around to the driver's side and got in and started up the car and maneuvered it out of the parking place and headed off. The Camaro gave a great throaty roar. Martin returned to the Dodge and got behind the wheel.
"I'm putting you in for a community relations commendation, Marty," said Goldberg.
"Kid's lucky I didn't run a check," said Martin. "Besides, that's the only parking place in a fucking block."
"And they wonder why people hate them in the ghetto," thought Kramer. Yet in that very moment he marveled, marveled. He, Kramer, was big enough and strong enough to have fought the boy with the wrench, and conceivably he might have beaten him. But he would have had to do that. If he had confronted the boy, it would have reached the fighting stage immediately. But Martin knew from the beginning that it wouldn't. He knew that something in his eyes would make the boy sense Irish cop who don't back off. Of course, it didn't hurt to have Goldberg sitting there looking like the original cruel thug, and it didn't hurt to have a .38 under your jacket. Nevertheless, Kramer knew he couldn't have done what this outrageous little featherweight champion of the breed had done. And for the 500th time in his career as an assistant district attorney in the Bronx, he paid silent homage to that most mysterious and coveted of male attributes, Irish machismo. Martin parked the Dodge in the space the boy had vacated, and the three of them sat back and waited.
"Bullshit rains," said Martin.
"Hey, Marty,"
said Kramer, proud to be on a first-name basis with this paragon. "You guys find out who gave that printout to the City Light?" Without turning around, Martin said,
"One of the brothers,"
giving an Irish rendition of a black accent. He turned his head slightly and twisted his lips to indicate it was about what you would expect, and that there was nothing to be done about it.
"You gonna check out all 124 cars, or whatever it is?"
"Yeah. Weiss has been on the CO's case all day."
"How long will it take?"
3 or 4 days. He's assigned 6 men. Bullshit rains."
Goldberg turned around and said to Kramer,
"What's with Weiss? Does he really believe this shit he reads in the newspapers, or what?"
"That's all he believes," said Kramer. "And anything with a racial angle drives him crazy. Like I told you, he's up for re-election."
"Yeah, but what makes him think we're gonna find witnesses at this demonstration, which is pure bullshit?"
"I don't know, but that's what he told Bernie." Goldberg shook his head.
"We don't even have a location where the goddamn thing happened. You realize that? Marty and me been up and down Bruckner Boulevard, and I'll be goddamned if we can establish where it happened. That's another thing the kid forgot to tell his mother when he came up with the bullshit license plate, where it's fucking supposed to have happened."
"Speaking of that," said Kramer, "how would a kid in the Poe Project even know what a Mercedes looks like?"
"Oh, they know that," said Martin without turning his head. "The pimps and wise guys drive the Mercedes."
"Yeah," said Goldberg. "They won't look at a Cadillac anymore. You see these kids with these things, these hood ornaments from the Mercedes hanging around their necks. If a kid up here wants to think up a bullshit car for a bullshit story," said Martin, "the Mercedes is the first one he's going to think of. Bernie knows that."
"Well, Weiss is all over Bernie's case, too," said Kramer. He looked around some more. The huge project was so quiet it was eerie. "You sure this is the right place, Marty? There's nobody here."
"Don't worry," said Martin. "They'll be here. Bullshit rains."
Pretty soon, a bronze-colored passenger van pulled into the block and stopped up ahead of them. About a dozen men got out. All of them were black. Most of them wore blue work shirts and dungarees. They appeared to be in their 20s or early 30s. One of them stood out because he was so tall. He had an angular profile and a large Adam's apple and wore a gold ring in one ear. He said something to the others, and they began pulling lengths of lumber out of the van. These turned out to be the shafts of picket signs. They stacked the signs on the sidewalk. Half the men leaned up against the van and began talking and smoking cigarettes.
"I've seen that tall asshole somewhere," said Martin.
"I think I've seen him too," said Goldberg. "Oh, shit, yes. He's one of Bacon's assholes, the one they call Buck. He was at that thing on Gun Hill Road."
Martin sat up straight.
"You're right, Davy. That's the same asshole."
He stared across the street at the man.
"I'd really love to..."
He spoke in a dreamy fashion.
"Please, you asshole, please, just do one stupid thing, you asshole.
I'm getting out." Martin got out of the Dodge and stood on the sidewalk and very ostentatiously began rolling his shoulders and arms about like a prize fighter loosening up. Then Goldberg got out. So Kramer got out, too. The demonstrators across the street began staring at them. Now one of them, a powerfully built young man in a blue work shirt and blue jeans, came walking across the street with a cool pimp roll and approached Martin.
"Yo," he said. "You from the TV?"
Martin put his chin down and shook his head no, very slowly, in a way that was pure menace. The black man measured him with his eyes and said,
"Then where you from, Jack?"
"Jump City, Agnes," said Martin.
The young man tried a scowl, then he tried a smile, and he got nothing with either one but a face full of Irish contempt. He turned around and walked back across the street and said something to the others, and the one named Buck stared at Martin. Martin stared back with a pair of shamrock lasers. Buck turned his head and gathered four or five of the others around him in a huddle. From time to time they stole glances at Martin. This Mexican standoff had been going on for a few minutes when another van arrived. Some young white people got out, seven men and three women. They looked like college students, with the exception of one woman with long, wavy, gray-blonde hair.
"Yo, Buck!"
she sang out. She went up to the tall man with the gold earring and held out both her hands and smiled broadly. He took her hands, although not all that enthusiastically, and said,
"Hey, how you doing, Riva?"
The woman pulled him toward her and kissed him on one cheek, and then on the other.
"Oh, give me a fucking break," said Goldberg. "That skank."
"You know her?" asked Kramer.
"Know who she is. She's a fucking communist."
Then the white woman, Riva, turned around and said something, and a white man and a white woman went back to the van and hauled out more placards. Presently, a third van arrived. Nine or ten more white people got out, male and female, most of them young. They hauled a big roll of cloth out of the van and unfurled it. It was a banner. Kramer could make out the words, "Gay Fist Strike Force Against Racism."
"What the hell's that?"
he said.
"That's the lesbos and the gaybos," said Goldberg.
"What are they doing here?"
"They're at all of these things. They must like the fresh air. They really get it on."
"But what's their interest in the case?"
"Don't ask me. The unity of the oppressed, they call it. Any of these groups need bodies, they'll show up."
So now there were about two dozen white and a dozen black demonstrators lolling about, chatting and assembling placards and banners. Now a car arrived. Two men got out. One of them carried two cameras on straps around his neck and a saddlebag with the printed logo, "The City Light," taped to it. The other was a tall man, in his 30s, with a long nose and blonde hair that flowed from a narrow widow's peak. His fair complexion was splotched with red. He wore a blue blazer of an unusual and, to Kramer's eyes, foreign cut. For no apparent reason, he suddenly lurched to his left. He appeared to be in agony. He stood stock still on the sidewalk, tucked a spiral notebook under his left arm, closed his eyes, and pressed both hands to his temples, massaged them for a long time, then opened his eyes, and winced and blinked, and looked all about. Martin began to laugh.
"Look at that face! Looks like a working vat of rye mash! Guy's so hungover, he's bleeding into his squash!"
Fallow lurched to his left again. He kept listening to port. Something was seriously wrong with his vestibular system. It was absolutely poisonous, this one, as if his brain were wrapped in membranous strings, like the strings of the membranes of an orange, and each contraction of his heart tightened the strings, and the poison was squeezed into his system. He had had throbbing headaches before, but this was a toxic headache, poisonous in the extreme. Where were the crowds? Had they come to the wrong place? There seemed to be a handful of black people and about 20 white students just standing about. A huge banner said "Gay Fist." Gay Fist? He had dreaded the thought of the noise and the commotion, but now he was worried about the silence. On the sidewalk, just ahead of him, was the same tall black man with the gold earring who had driven him and Vogel up here 2 days ago. Vogel. He closed his eyes. Vogel had taken him to dinner at Lester's last night as a kind of celebration payment for the article. He had a vodka Southside, then another one, the snout of the beast, lit up by a radium-blue flare. Tony Stock and Caroline Heftshank came over and sat down, and Fallow tried to apologize for what had happened with her young friend, Chirazzi, the artist, and Caroline gave him a strange smile and said he shouldn't worry about that. And he had another vodka Southside. And Caroline kept drinking Frascati and shrieking to Britt Withers in a very silly way, and finally he came over, and she unbuttoned his shirt and pulled the hair on his chest so hard he swore, and then Fallow and Caroline were in Britt Withers's office upstairs, where Britt Withers had a watery-eyed bull terrier on a chain, and Caroline kept looking at Fallow with her strange smile, and he tried to unbutton her blouse, and she laughed at him and patted him on the bottom, contemptuously, but it made him feel crazy and a ripple. The beast stirred in the icy depths, and she curved her finger and beckoned, and he knew she was mocking him, but he walked across the office anyway, and there was a machine, something about a machine and a radium-blue flare, thrashing, heading for the surface, a rubbery flap. He could almost see it now, almost. And she was mocking him, but he didn't care. And she kept pressing something, and the radium blue flared from inside, and there was a grinding hum, and she reached down and she picked it up. She showed him. He could almost see it. No holding it back. It broke through the surface and looked at him straight down its filthy snout. And it was like a woodblock outlined in a radium aura against a black ground, and the beast kept staring at him down its snout, and he wanted to open his eyes to drive it away, but he couldn't, and the bull terrier started growling, and Caroline no longer looked at him, even to show her contempt. And so he touched her on the shoulder, but she was suddenly all business, and the machine kept grinding and humming and grinding and humming and flaring in radium blue. And then she had a stack of pictures in her hand, and she ran down the stairs to the restaurant, and he kept keeling to one side, and then a terrible thought came to him. He ran down the stairs, which were in a tight spiral, and that made him dizzier. On the floor of the restaurant, so many roaring faces and boiling teeth, and Caroline Heftshank was standing near the bar showing the picture to Cecil Smallwood and Billy Cortez, and then there were pictures all over the place, and he was thrashing through the tables and the people grabbing for the pictures. He opened his eyes and tried to keep them open. The Bronx. The Bronx. He was in the Bronx. He walked toward the man with the gold earring. Buck. He kept listening to port. He felt dizzy. He wondered if he had suffered a stroke.
"Hello,"
he said to Buck. He meant it to be cheery, but it came out as a gasp. Buck looked at him with a trace of recognition, so he said,
"Peter Fallow, from the City Light."
"Oh, hey, how you doing, bro?"
The black man's tone was agreeable, but not enthusiastic. The author of the brilliant scoops in the City Light had expected enthusiasm. The black man resumed his conversation with the woman.
"When does the demonstration begin?" said Fallow.
Buck looked up distractedly.
"Soon's Channel One gets here."
By the time he reached the word "here," he was once again looking at the woman.
"But where are the people?"
He stared at Fallow and paused, as if trying to figure him out.
"They'll be here soon's Channel One gets here."
He used the sort of voice you use for someone who is blameless but dense.
"I see," said Fallow, who couldn't see at all. "When, as you say, Channel One arrives, what takes place then?"
"Give the man the release, Reva," said Buck.
An intense, demented-looking white woman dug down into a big vinyl tote bag on the sidewalk by her feet and handed him two pieces of paper stapled together. The paper, which was Xeroxed, radium blue, the snout, bore the letterhead of the American People's Alliance. A headline, typed in capital letters, said, "The People Demand Action in the Lamb Case." Fallow started to read it, but the words ran together like goulash in front of his face. Just then, a bouncy young white man materialized. He was wearing an appallingly tasteless tweed jacket.
"Neil Flanagan from the Daily News," said the bouncy man. "What's going on?"
The woman named Reva dug out another press release. Mr. Neil Flanagan, like Fallow himself, was accompanied by a photographer. The bouncy Mr. Flanagan had nothing to say to Fallow, but the two photographers fell in with one another at once. Fallow could hear them complaining about the assignment. Fallow's photographer, an odious little man who wore a cap, kept using the expression, "crock of shit." That was all that American newspaper photographers seemed to talk about with any relish whatsoever, their displeasure at being asked to leave the office and take pictures. The dozen demonstrators, meantime, were clearly unmoved by the presence of representatives of two of the city's tabloids, the City Light and the Daily News. They continued to lounge about the van, their rage, if any, about the injustices wrought upon Henry Lamb successfully contained. Fallow tried once more to read the press release, but soon gave up. He looked about. The Poe Towers remained peaceful, abnormally so, given their size. On the other side of the street stood three white men. There was a little man in a tan windbreaker, a big, porcine man with a drooping mustache wearing a warm-up jacket, and a balding man with blunt features wearing a poorly made gray suit and a Yank striped necktie. Fallow wondered who they were, but mainly he wanted to sleep. He wondered if he could sleep standing up, like a horse. Presently he heard the woman Reva say to Buck, "I think that's them." Both of them looked down the street. The demonstrators came to life. Coming up the street was a large white van. On its side, in huge letters, was the inscription, "The Live One." Buck, Reva, and the demonstrators began walking toward it. Mr. Neil Flanagan, the two photographers, and finally Fallow himself tagged along behind them. Channel One had arrived. The van came to a stop, and out of the passenger side of the front seat came a young man with a great fluffy head of dark curly hair and a navy blazer and tan pants.
"Robert Corso," said Reva, reverently.
The side doors of the van slid open, and two young men in jeans and sweaters and running shoes stepped out. The driver stayed at the wheel. Buck hurried forward.
"Yo, Robert Corso, how you doing, man?"
Suddenly, Buck had a smile that lit up the street.
"Okay," said Robert Corso, trying to sound enthusiastic in return. "Okay."
He obviously had no idea who this black man with the gold earring was.
"What do you want us to do?" asked Buck.
The bouncy young man broke in.
"Hey, Corso, Neil Flanagan, Daily News."
"Oh, hi. What you want us to...
Where you guys been? What you want us to..."
Robert Corso looked at his watch.
"It's only 5:10. We're going on live at 6. We got plenty of time."
"Yeah, but I got a 7 o'clock deadline."
"What do you want us to do?" Buck insisted.
"Well, hey," said Robert Corso. "I don't know. What would you do if I wasn't here?"
Buck and Reva looked at him with funny little grins on as if he must be joking.
"Where are Reverend Bacon and Mrs. Lamb?" said Robert Corso.
"In Mrs. Lamb's apartment," said Reva.
Fallow took it badly. No one had bothered to apprise him of this fact.
"Hey, whatever you say," said Buck.
Robert Corso shook his great fluffy head. He muttered,
"Well, hell, I can't run this thing for you."
Then to Buck, "It'll take us a little while to set up. I guess the sidewalk's the best place. I want to get the buildings in the background." Buck and Reva went to work. They began gesturing and giving instructions to the demonstrators, who now went back toward their van and began picking up the picket signs, which were stacked on the sidewalk. A few people had begun drifting over from the Poe Towers to the scene. Fallow gave up on Buck and Reva and approached Robert Corso.
"Excuse me," he said. "I'm Peter Fallow from the City Light. Did I hear you say that Reverend Bacon and Mrs. Lamb are here?"
"Fallow," said Robert Corso. "You're the one who wrote the stories?"
He held out his hand and shook Fallow's with enthusiasm.
"I'm afraid so."
"You're the reason we're up at this goddamn place,"
he said it with an appreciative smile.
"Sorry about that."
Fallow felt a glow inside. This was the sort of tribute he expected all along, but he hadn't expected to get it from a TV person. Robert Corso turned serious.
"Do you think Bacon is really on the level about this one?"
"Well, obviously you do."
"You don't?"
asked Fallow.
"Ah, hell, you never know with Bacon. He's fairly outrageous, but when I interviewed Mrs. Lamb, I was impressed, to tell you the truth. She seems like a good person to me. She's bright, she's got a steady job, she has a nice, neat little apartment. I was impressed. I don't know, I believe her. What do you think?"
"You've already interviewed her? I thought you were getting ready to interview her here."
"Well, yeah, but that's just for the wraparound. We'll wrap around live at 6 o'clock.
"Wrap around live? I don't believe I know about wrapping around live."
The irony was lost on the American, however.
"Well, what we do is, I came up here with a crew this afternoon after your story came out. Thanks a lot for that. I really love assignments in the Bronx. Anyway, we interviewed Mrs. Lamb, and we interviewed a couple of the neighbors, and we got some footage of Bruckner Boulevard and the place where the boy's father was killed and all that stuff, and some stills of the boy. So we've already got most of the story on tape. It'll run for about 2 minutes, and what we do now is, we go on live during the demonstration, and then we'll roll the tape, and then we'll cut back in live and wrap it up with a live segment. That's wrapping it up live."
"But what will you show? There's no one here but this lot. Most of them are white."
Fallow motioned toward Buck and Reva.
"Oh, don't worry. There'll be plenty of people here as soon as our telescope goes up."
"Your telescope?"
"Our remote transmitter."
Robert Corso looked toward the van. Fallow followed his eyes. He could see the two crewmen in blue jeans inside.
"Your remote transmitter? By the way, where are your competitors?"
"Our competitors?"
"The other television stations."
"Oh, we were promised an exclusive."
"Really? By whom?"
"Bacon, I guess. That's what I don't like about the setup. Bacon's so fucking manipulative. He's got a pipeline to my producer, Irv Stone. You know Irv?"
"I'm afraid I don't."
"You've heard of him?"
Actually, I haven't."
"He's won a lot of awards." Irv's all right, but he's one of these old bastards who was a campus radical back in the 1960s when they were having the anti-war demonstrations and everything.
He thinks Bacon's this romantic leader of the people. He's a fucking operator, is what I think. But anyway, he promised Irv an exclusive if he'd put it on live at 6 o'clock.
That's very cozy. But why would he want to do that? Why wouldn't he want all the stations to be here?
Because that way he might get nothing out of it. I bet you every day there's 20 or 30 demonstrations going on in New York, and they're all competing for coverage. This way he knows we'll play it big. If we go to the trouble of sending out the remote van, and if we go live, and if we think we have an exclusive, then it'll go at the top of the news. It'll be live, and it'll be a big deal. And tomorrow, 5 and 7 and 2 and the rest of them will figure they better cover the story, too.
I see, said Fallow. But how could he guarantee you, as you say, an exclusive? What will prevent the other, channels from coming here?
Nothing, except that he won't tell them the time or the place.
He wasn't so considerate of me, was he? Said Fallow. I noticed the Daily News seems to have the time and the place.
Yes, said Robert Corso. But you've had exclusives for 2 days now. Now he has to let the other newspapers in on it. He paused. His handsome, young, fluffy-haired American face looked melancholy all of a sudden. But you do think it's a legitimate story, don't you?
Oh, absolutely, Fallow said.
Corso said, This Henry Lamb is a nice kid. An honor student, no police record, he's quiet, the neighbors seem to like him. Isn't that the way it strikes you?
Oh, no question about it,
said the creator of the honor student. Riva approached them.
We're all set, just say when.
Robert Corso and Fallow looked to the sidewalk where the 3 dozen pickets were now lined up informally. They held the shafts of the picket signs on their shoulders like wooden guns. Robert Corso said, Bacon's ready? And Mrs. Lamb? Riva said,
Well, you tell me your buck. Reverend Bacon doesn't want to come down here with Mrs. Lamb and just stand around, but he's ready.
Okay, said Robert Corso. He turned toward the Live One van. Hey, Frank, you guys ready? From inside the van. Just about. A heavy whirring noise began. Out of the top of the van rose a silvery shaft, a cylinder. Attached to the top of the shaft was a day-glow orange banner, or bunting. No, it was a cable, a heavily insulated cable, wide but flat, like an electric eel. The screaming orange eel was wrapped around the shaft in a spiral. The silvery shaft and the orange spiral kept rising, rising, rising. The shaft was in sections like a telescope, and it went up, 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 and the van whirred and whirred and whirred. People began emerging from the silent towers of the project, which was silent no longer. A boiling noise, the boiling noise of many voices, rose from the blasted heath. Here they came, men, women, packs of boys, young children, their eyes fastened to the ascending silver and orange lance and its radiation orange banner. Now the shaft had risen 2.5 stories above the street, with its orange eel wrapped around it. The street and the sidewalk were empty no longer. A huge, good-natured crowd gathered around for the Beano. A woman yelled out,
Robert Corso!
Channel 1, the fluffy-haired man who would be on TV. Robert Corso looked toward the pickets, who had formed a lazy oval on the sidewalk and were beginning to march. Buck and Riva stood by. Buck had a bullhorn in his hand. He kept his eyes pinned on Robert Corso. Then Robert Corso looked toward his crewmen. His cameraman stood 6 feet away. The camera looked very small next to the van and the tremendous shaft, but the crowd was spellbound by its deep, deep cataract eye. The camera wasn't even on, but every time the cameraman turned to talk to the sound man and the great eye swung about, a ripple went through the crowd, as if the machine had its own invisible kinetic momentum. Buck looked at Robert Corso and raised one hand, palm up, which asked, When? Robert Corso shrugged and then wearily pointed his finger toward Buck. Buck lifted the bullhorn to his mouth and yelled,
"What do we want?"
"Justice!"
chanted the 36 pickets. Their voices sounded terribly thin against the backdrop of the crowd and the towers of the project and the splendid silver lance of the Live One.
"What do we get?"
"Racism!"
"What do we want?"
"Justice!"
They were a little louder, but not much.
"What do we get?"
"Racism!"
6 or 8 boys in their early teens were shoving and bumping one another and laughing, struggling to get into the camera's line of vision. Fallow stood off to one side of the star, Robert Corso, who was holding his microphone but saying nothing. The man with the high-tech horn moved closer to the oval line of pickets and the crowd heaved in response. The signs and banners came bobbing by. "Weiss justice is white justice. Lamb, slaughtered by indifference. Liberate Johanna Bronx. Gay fist strike force against racism. The people cry out, avenge Henry. Quit stalling, Abe. Gay and lesbian New York demand justice for our brother Henry Lamb. Capitalism plus racism equals legalized murder. Hit and run and lie to the people. Action now."
"What do we want?"
"Justice."
"What do we get?"
"Racism."
Buck turned the bullhorn toward the crowd. He wanted to get their voices into the act.
"What do we want?"
Nothing came back. In the best of moods, they watched the show. Buck answered his own question.
"Justice. What do we get?"
"Nothing."
"Racism. Okay, what do we want?"
"Nothing."
"Brothers and sisters,"
said Buck, the red bullhorn in front of his face.
"Our brother, our neighbor, Henry Lamb, he was struck down by a hit-and-run driver, and the hospital, they don't do nothing for him, and the cops and the DA, they can't be bothered. Henry's at death's door, and they don't care. Henry's an honor student, and they say, so what? 'Cause he's poor. He's from the project, 'cause he's black. So why are we here, brothers and sisters? To make Chuck do the right thing."
That brought some appreciative laughter from the crowd.
"To get justice for our brother Henry Lamb," Buck continued. "Okay, so what do we want?"
"Justice," said voices from the crowd. "And what do we get?"
Laughter and stares. The laughter came from 6 or 8 boys in their early teens who were shoving and bumping one another, struggling to occupy a position just behind Buck. That would put them in a direct line with the eye of the camera, whose mesmerizing red light was now on.
"Who's Chuck?" asked Kramer.
"Chuck is Charlie," said Martin. "And Charlie is the man. And speaking for the man, I'd like to get my hands on that big shit cake."
"You see those signs?" asked Kramer. "Weiss justice is white justice and quit stalling, Abe."
"Yeah?"
"If they show that on TV, Weiss is gonna fucking freak out."
"It's already freaked out if you ask me," said Goldberg. "Look at this bullshit."
From where Kramer, Goldberg, and Martin stood, the scene across the street was a curious little theater in the round. The play concerned the media. Beneath the towering spire of a TV van, 36 figures, 24 of them white, marched about in a small oval carrying signs. 11 people, 2 of them black, 9 of them white, attended them, in order to bring their thin voices and felt-tip marker messages to a city of 7 million. A man with a bullhorn, a woman with a tote bag, a fluffy-haired TV announcer, a cameraman and a sound man, attached to the van by umbilical cords, 2 technicians visible inside the open sliding doors of the van driver, 2 newspaper photographers and 2 newspaper reporters with notebooks in their hands, one of them still lurching to port every now and again. An audience of 200 or 300 souls was packed in around them, enjoying the spectacle.
"Okay," said Martin. "Time to start talking to witnesses."
He started walking across the street toward the crowd.
"Hey, Marty," said Goldberg. "Be cool, okay?"
Took the words right out of Kramer's mouth. This was not the ideal setting for trying to demonstrate Irish machismo to the world.
He had a horrible vision of Martin taking the bullhorn from the man with the earring and trying to stuff it down his throat before the assembled residents of the Poe Towers. The three of them, Kramer, Martin, and Goldberg, were halfway across the street when the pickets and the crowd suddenly got religion. They began making a real racket. Buck was bellowing something on the bullhorn. The cameraman's high-tech proboscis was weaving this way and that. From somewhere a tall figure had appeared, a man with a black suit and a terrific stiff white collar and a black necktie with white stripes. With him was a small black woman wearing a dark dress with a luster like silk or satin. It was Reverend Bacon and Mrs. Lamb. Sherman was halfway across the marble floor of the entry gallery when he saw Judy sitting in the library. She was sitting in the wing chair, with a magazine on her lap, watching television. She looked up at him. What was that look? It was surprise, not warmth. If she would give him even a hint of warmth, he would go straight in and tell her. Oh, yes? Tell her what? Tell her about the debacle in the office, at least? About the way Arnold Parch had talked to him, and worse, looked at him? The others, too. As if... He avoided forming in words what they must have thought of him. His disappearance, the collapse of the gold-backed bond scheme, and then tell her the rest, too? Had she by now seen a newspaper article about a Mercedes RF? But there was not a hint of warmth. There was only surprise. It was 6 o'clock. He hadn't been home this early in a long time. There was only surprise in that sad, thin face with the corona of soft brown hair. He kept walking toward her. He would go in the library anyway. He would sit down in the other armchair and watch television, too. That had been silently agreed upon. The two of them could sit together in the library and read or watch television. That way they could go through the frozen motions of being a family for Campbell's benefit as much as anything else, without having to talk.
Daddy!
He turned around. Campbell was coming toward him from the door that led to the kitchen. She had a glorious smile on her face. It nearly broke his heart. Hello, sweetheart! He put his hands under her armpits and swept her up off the floor and wrapped his arms around her. She put her arms around his neck and her legs around his waist, and she said,
Daddy, guess what I made?
What?
A rabbit.
You did? A rabbit?
I'll show you.
She started wriggling to get down. You'll show me. He didn't want to see her rabbit, not now, but the obligation to seem enthusiastic overwhelmed him. He let her slither to the floor.
Come on.
She took him by the hand and began pulling with terrific force. She pulled him off balance. Hey, where are we going?
Come on, it's in the kitchen.
Towing him toward the kitchen, she now leaned so far over that almost the entire weight of her body hung from his hand, which held hers. Hey, watch it. You're going to fall down, sweetheart.
Come on!
He lurched behind her, ground between his fears and his love for a 6-year-old who wanted to show him a rabbit. The doorway led into a short hallway, lined with closets, and then into the butler's pantry, lined with glass-front cabinets containing sparkling battalions of crystal and stainless steel sinks. The cabinets, with their beadings, muntins, mullions, cornices, he couldn't remember all the terms, had cost thousands, thousands. The passion Judy had put into these things, the way they had spent money, hemorrhaging money. And now they were in the kitchen. More cabinets, cornices, stainless steel, tiles, spotlights, the Sub-Zero, the Vulcan, all of it the best Judy's endless research could find, all of it endlessly expensive, hemorrhaging and hemorrhaging. Bonita was by the Vulcan stove.
Hi, Mr. McCoy.
Hello, Bonita. Lucille the maid was sitting on a stool by a counter drinking a cup of coffee. Mr. McCoy? Why, hello, Lucille. Hadn't seen her in ages, hadn't been home early enough. He should have something to say to her, since it had been so long, but he couldn't think of a thing except for how sad it all was. They were proceeding with their routines, secure in their belief that everything was the way it always had been.
"Over here, Daddy,"
Campbell kept pulling. She didn't want him to get sidetracked talking to Bonita and Lucille.
"Campbell," said Bonita, "don't pull your daddy like that."
Sherman smiled and felt ineffectual. Campbell ignored her. Then she stopped pulling.
"Bonita's gonna bake it for me, so it'll be hard."
There was the rabbit. It was on a white formica-topped table. Sherman stared. He could scarcely believe it. It was an astonishingly good rabbit, made of clay. It was primitive in execution, but the head was cocked to one side, and the ears were set at expressive angles, and the legs were spread out in an unconventional pose, as bunnies went, and the massing and proportion of the haunches was excellent. The animal seemed startled.
"Sweetheart, you did this?" Very proud.
"Yes."
"Where?"
"In school."
"All by yourself?"
"Yes, for real life."
"Well, Campbell, this is a beautiful rabbit. I'm very proud of you. You're so talented."
Very timid.
"I know."
All at once he wanted to cry. A startled bunny. To think of what it meant to be able to wish in this world to make a bunny rabbit and then to do it. In all innocence, in all confidence that the world would receive it with love and tenderness and admiration. To think of what she assumed at the age of 6, namely, that this was the nature of the world, and that her mommy and daddy, her daddy, made it that way, and of course, would never let it be any other way.
"Let's show it to mommy," he said.
"She saw it."
"I bet she loved it,"
the very timid voice.
"I know."
"Well, let's both show it to her."
"Bonita has to bake it, so it'll be hard."
"Well, I want to go tell Mommy how much I like it."
With a show of gusto, he swept Campbell up into his arms and threw her over his shoulder. She took this as a great game.
"Daddy!"
"Campbell, you're getting so big. Soon I won't be able to carry you like a sack of meal anymore. Low bridge, we're going through the door."
Amid much giggling and wriggling, he carried her across the marble floor to the library. Judy looked up sharply.
"Campbell, don't make Daddy carry you. You're too big for that."
With just a touch of defiance.
"I didn't make him."
"We were just playing," said Sherman. "Did you see Campbell's rabbit? Isn't it beautiful?"
"Yes, it's lovely."
She turned her head back toward the television set.
"I'm really impressed. I think we've got an extremely talented little girl on our hands."
No reply. Sherman lowered Campbell from his shoulder down into his arms, as if she were a baby, and then sat in the armchair and settled her on his lap. Campbell moved around to get more comfortable and snuggled up against him, and he put his arms around her. They looked at the television screen. The news was on. An announcer's voice, a blur of black faces, a picket sign. Action, now.
"What are they doing, Daddy?"
"It looks like a demonstration, sweetheart."
Another sign. "Weiss justice is white justice." "Weiss?"
"What's a demonstration?"
Campbell sat up in his lap and looked at him when she asked the question, obscuring his view of the screen. He tried to look around her.
"What's a demonstration?"
Distractedly, trying to keep one eye on the screen.
Sometimes when people get angry about something, they make some signs and they march around with them.
Hit and run and lie to the people. Hit and run.
"What do they get angry about?"
"Just a minute, sweetheart."
"What do they get angry about, Daddy?"
"Almost anything."
Sherman was now leaning far to the left in order to see the screen. He had to hold tight to Campbell's waist to keep from spilling her off his lap.
"But what?"
"Well, let's see."
Campbell turned her head toward the screen, but immediately turned back. There was only some man talking, some black man, very tall, dressed in a black jacket and a white shirt and a striped tie, standing next to a thin black woman in a dark dress. There was a huge cluster of black faces crowded in behind them. Boys with smirks on their faces kept popping out from behind them and staring into the camera.
when a young man like Henry Lamb, the man was saying, an honor student, an outstanding young man, when a young man like Henry Lamb comes into the hospital with acute cerebral concussion and they treat him for a broken wrist, see? When his mother gives the police department and the district attorney a description of the car that struck him down, a description of that car, see? And they do nothing. They drag their feet.
Daddy, let's go back to the kitchen. Bonita's gonna bake my rabbit.
In a second. To our people is, we don't care. Your young people, your honor students, your hopes don't count. Don't matter at all. See? That's the message. But we care, and we're not gonna stand still, and we're not gonna be silent. If the power structure don't want to do nothing.
Campbell slid off Sherman's lap and grabbed his right wrist with both hands and began pulling.
Come on, Daddy!
The face of the thin black woman filled the screen. Tears rolled down her cheeks. A fluffy-haired young white man was on the screen with a microphone at his lips. There was a whole universe of black faces behind him, and more boys mugging for the camera.
That as yet unidentified Mercedes-Benz sedan with a license plate beginning with R.E., R.F., R.B., or R.P., and just as Reverend Bacon maintains that a message is coming through to this community from the authorities, these protesters have a message for them. If you don't launch a full-scale investigation, we'll do it ourselves. This is Robert Corso, the live one, in the Bronx.
Daddy!
She was pulling on him so hard the chair began to tip.
R.F.?
Judy had turned to look at Sherman.
Ours begins with R.F., doesn't it?
Now, tell her.
Daddy, come on! I want to bake the rabbit!
There was no concern in Judy's face. She was merely surprised by the coincidence. So surprised, she had initiated a conversation. Now.
Daddy, come on!
See about baking the rabbit.
Chapter 14. I Don't Know How to Lie. Sherman woke up from a dream he couldn't remember, with his heart flailing away at his chest wall. It was the drinker's hour, that hour in the dead of the night when drinkers and insomniacs suddenly wake up and know it's all over, this sleep dodge. He resisted the urge to look at the illuminated clock on the radio on the table beside the bed. He didn't want to know how many hours he would have to lie here fighting with this stranger, his heart, which was desperate to escape to some far, 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 far Canada. The windows were open on Park and on the side street. Between the sills and the bottom of the shades was a band of purplish gloom. He heard an automobile, a lone automobile, starting off from a stoplight. Then he heard an airplane. It was not a jet, but an airplane with a propeller. The motor stopped. It was going to crash. Then he heard it again, droning and groaning over New York City. How very odd. In the dead of night, his wife slept 15 inches away, on the other side of the Berlin Wall, breathing regularly, oblivious. She was turned away from him, on her side, her knees bent. How nice it would be to roll toward her and tuck his knees in behind hers and press his chest upon her back. Once they were able, once, when they were so close, they could do that without waking each other up, in the dead of the night. This couldn't be true. There was no way they could break through these walls to invade his life. The tall, skinny boy, the newspapers, police, at the drinker's hour. His dear, sweet daughter slept down the hall. Dear Campbell, a happy little girl, oblivious. A mist came to his wide-open eyes. He stared at the ceiling and tried to trick himself into falling back asleep. He thought of other things. That girl he met in the dining room of the hotel in Cleveland that time, the businesslike way she undressed in front of him, as contrasted with Maria, who did this and that, gorged red with lust. Lust had led him into it, the bowels of the Bronx, the tall, skinny boy. Down he goes. There were no other things. Everything was tied to these things. And he lay there with them flaring up in his mind in ghastly pictures, the ghastly faces on the television screen, Arnold Parch's dreary face with its ghastly attempted sternness, the evasive voice of Bernard Levy, the look on Muriel's face as if she knew he now bore some terrible taint and was no longer an Olympian at Pierce and Pierce, hemorrhaging money. Surely these were dreams. His eyes were wide open, staring at the purplish gloom where the Roman shades fell just short of the windowsill. In the dead of the night, dreading the light of the dawn. He got up early, walked Campbell to the bus stop, bought the newspapers on Lexington Avenue, and took a taxi down to Pierce and Pierce. In the Times, nothing. In the Post, nothing. In the Daily News, only a picture and a caption. The picture showed pickets and a crowd. A sign in the foreground said, "Weiss justice is white justice." In another 2 hours, the city light would be on the stands. It was a quiet day at Pierce and Pierce, at least for him. He made his routine calls to Prudential, Morgan Guarantee, Allen & Company. The city light. Felix was over on the other side of the room. Even to attempt to use him again would be too demeaning. Not a word from Arnold Parch or anyone else. Freezing me out? The city light. He would call Freddy and have him get the newspaper. Freddy could read it to him. So he called Freddy. But he had left the office for an appointment. He called Maria. Nowhere to be found. The city light. He couldn't stand it any longer. He would go downstairs and buy the newspaper and read it in the lobby and return. Yesterday he was AWOL when a bond issue came in. He blew millions, millions in the gold-backed bonds. How much worse could one more transgression make it? As coolly as he could, he began walking across the bond trading room toward the elevators. No one seemed to notice. No one any longer cares. Downstairs at the newsstand in the lobby, he looked left and right and then bought the city light. He walked over behind a big pink marble column. His heart was pounding away. How grim, how odd, to live in personal fear every day of the newspapers in New York. Nothing on the front page, or page 2, or page 3. It was on page 5, a picture and a story by this person, Peter Fallow. The picture showed the thin black woman crying, while the tall black man in the suit comforted her. Bacon. There were picket signs in the background. The story was not long. He raced through it, fury of the community, luxury car, white driver. No clear indication what the police were doing. At the end of the article was a box that said, "Editorial, page 36. His heart started racing again. His fingers shook as he rustled forward toward page 36. There, at the top of the editorial column, the heading, "Hit or Miss Justice." On Monday, the City Lights' Peter Fallow broke the tragic story of Henry Lamb, the Bronx honor student who was critically injured in a hit-and-run accident and abandoned, just like another piece of debris in a littered city. True, from a legal standpoint, Henry Lamb's is not a tidy case, but neither has he enjoyed a tidy life. He managed to survive the worst that growing up in a city housing project could throw his way, including the murder of his father by a mugger, and achieved an outstanding record at Rupert High School. He was struck down on the threshold of a brilliant future. Our pity is not enough for Henry Lamb and the many other good people who are determined to beat the odds in the less affluent sections of our city. They need to know that their hopes and dreams are important to the future of all New York. We call for an aggressive investigation of every angle of the Lamb case. He was rocked. The thing was becoming a crusade. He stared at the newspaper. Should he save it? No. Better not to be seen with it. He looked for a trash receptacle or a bench. Nothing. He closed the newspaper up and folded it in two and let it fall on the floor behind the column, and hurried back to the elevators. He had lunch at his desk, a sandwich and orange juice, in the interest of appearing diligent. He was jittery and dreadfully tired. He couldn't finish the sandwich. By early in the afternoon, he had an overwhelming desire to close his eyes. His head felt so heavy. The beginning of a headache had a tight grip on his forehead. He wondered if he was getting the flu. He ought to call Freddie Button, but he was so tired. Just then a call came in. It was Freddie calling him.
"It's funny, I was just thinking of calling you. There was this goddamned editorial today, Freddie."
"I know. I read it."
"You read it?"
"I read all four papers. Listen, Sherman, I've taken the liberty of calling Tommy Killian. Why don't you go see him? He's on Reed Street. It's not far from where you are, near City Hall. Give him a ring."
In his occluded smoker's voice, he recited a telephone number.
"I guess it doesn't look so great," said Sherman.
"It's not that. There's nothing in what I read that's of any material significance. It's just that it's taking on more of a political complexion, and Tommy will have a good fix on that."
"Okay. Thanks, Freddy. I'll call him."
Some Irishman on Reed Street named Tommy Killian. He didn't call him. He had such a headache, he closed his eyes and massaged his temples with the tips of his fingers. At 5 o'clock sharp, the official end of the day, he left. This was not good form. The end of the trading day was the beginning of the second part of the day for a master of the universe. The end of the trading day was like the end of a battle. After 5 o'clock, the masters of the universe took care of all the things people in other businesses spent the entire day doing. They figured out the net-net, which is to say the actual profit and loss for the day's work. They reviewed the markets, reviewed strategies, discussed personnel problems, researched new issues, and did all the reading of the financial press that was forbidden during the daily battle. They told war stories and beat their breasts and yodeled, if they deserved it. The one thing you never did was simply go home to the wife and kiddies. Sherman had Muriel order a car for him from the car service. He studied her face for signs of his fall from grace. A blank. Out in front of the building, the street was 4 and 5 deep with car service cars and white men in business suits threading their way among them, heads lowered, squinting, looking for their numbers. The name of the car service and the number of the car were always posted in a side window. Pearson Pierce used a company called Tango, all Oldsmobile and Buick sedans. Pearson Pierce ordered 300 to 400 rides a day, at an average of $15 per. Some clever devil at Tango, whoever owned it, was probably clearing $1 million a year on Pearson Pierce alone. Sherman was looking for Tango 278. He wandered amid the sea of sedans, occasionally caroming off men who looked much like himself, heads lowered, squinting, dark gray suits.
"Excuse me, excuse me."
The new rush hour. In the old movies, the Wall Street rush hour was all subways. Subways? Down there with them? Insulate. Today, roaming, roaming, amid the sedans, squinting, squinting.
"Excuse me, excuse me."
Finally, he found Tango 278. Bonita and Lucille were surprised to see him come walking in the apartment at 5:30. He didn't feel well enough to sound pleasant. Judy and Campbell weren't home. Judy had taken her over to a birthday party on the west side. Sherman trudged up the great curved staircase. He went into the bedroom and took off his jacket and his tie. Without taking off his shoes, he stretched out on the bed. He closed his eyes. He felt consciousness falling away, falling away. It was unbearably heavy, consciousness.
"Mr. McCoy. Mr. McCoy."
Bonita was standing over him. He couldn't figure out why.
"I no want disturb," she said. "The doorman,
He say two men from the police downstairs.
What?
The doorman. He say...
Downstairs?
Yes, he say from the police.
Sherman propped himself up on one elbow. There were his legs, stretched out on the bed. He couldn't figure out why. It must be morning, but he had his shoes on. Benita was standing over him. He rubbed his face.
Well, tell them I'm not here.
The doorman, he already say you here.
What do they want?
Don't know, Mr. McCoy.